Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered ChumbaCasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby. Mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa. Take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome to the Top Order Podcast. It's Bordy, Binksy and Lippy with you this evening. We've got, as always, a packed show. Glenn Phillips' aggression pays off for New Zealand. Was this the worst test match pitch ever? We'll do a bit of a spin watch as well, which we always do when you two are on the pod. We'll talk a little bit of Australia, Pakistan, a preview, and who's going to open the batting when David Warner finally rides off into the cricketing sunset. We're also going to cover England versus West Indies. Central contracts are loose as, apparently, in the English cricket board. Ben Duckett, the only high point for the English boys. Uncapped spinners to India. And Big Bash, what went wrong in Geelong? All coming up on the Top Order Podcast. Stay tuned.
How long have you been sitting on that line?
I've been sitting on what went wrong in Geelong for a little while, boys. But we'll probably finish with that, I think, in terms of our look at cricketing trivia. But those of you that don't know what I'm going on about, there's a match abandoned in the Big Bash due to a dangerous pitch, which we'll come on to. But I think we've got to start with New Zealand-Bangladesh Test Series. So I think, Lippy, I guess it's going to be over to you for your pre-prepared remarks, but we want to talk probably about Glenn Phillips batting in both innings. You know, took the right options, I think, in terms of the attacking option when it was there. And, you know, where does this rank in the, and I'll use a Raj word, the pantheon of New Zealand test match wins? But we'll also, I think, talk about the pitches and the spin selections as well. But yeah, what, we're 3 or 4 days after that. Fantastic climax to the test match, actually, as a neutral watching it. I switched it on with probably about 90 minutes to go, and it was great to watch as a neutral.
Maybe, but yeah, for you, yeah. Yeah,
but what about from your perspective?
It wasn't much fun to watch from my perspective when New Zealand was batting. Pretty fun when we were bowling, but, you know, obviously being a spinner, someone who appreciates spinners kind of having their moment, I certainly enjoyed when New Zealand was bowling. But yeah, I mean, look, let's start with Phillips, because I think the narrative of this test, you know, you mentioned pitches before. I think the narrative of this test match, a lot of it has been around the pitch and what happened and all of that stuff. But I think really, the big thing, the exciting thing is what Glenn Phillips did. And really, you know, while we were all sitting here talking about Ruchan Ravindra and, you know, the impact that he could have on the test team, here's Glenn Phillips, gets his opportunity. And look, you know, I think we could argue till the cows come home, or, you know, probably everyone around this table thinks that Ravindra should have been in that lineup somewhere. But the fact that if in the selector's mind, the decision was let's pick Ravindra or Phillips, well, they nailed it. Like, Phillips has had an absolutely brilliant series on two pitches that, you know, they were very different in terms of how difficult they were. This one in particular was incredibly difficult, and Glenn Phillips scored 127 runs and only dismissed once. So, you know, the impact for what he's done and the performance, I mean, those 127 runs, you would probably say that they were worth just about, you know, 300, 400 on a flat wicket. And in terms of what he's done maybe for, you know, the trajectory of his career, which we talked about what Ravindra might have done in the World Cup, Glenn Phillips' last couple of months, adding bowling to his bow, you know, at the runs that he scored, I think that's now played a big part in what we might see over the next 6 months to 6 to 12 months for Glenn Phillips. So very, very exciting.
Baldy, anything from you on Glenn Phillips?
Well, I think there's a big debate prior to the Test series about whether or not he was even going to play. And as you said, Stuart, the selectors have nailed the decision. If it was going to be between Phillips and Ravindra, and all other things being equal, he turned the ball the opposite way to Santner and Ajaz and Ish Sodhi, then the selectors have nailed that decision. We might not agree with it. I think everybody in cricketing circles has been just yelling 5-8, 5-7-8, 5-7-8, 5-7-8. Look how many runs Rachin Ravindra scored in the World Cup. Why isn't he in the team? But Glenn Phillips has absolutely nailed this series and should be absolutely rusted on for this home summer. He should be absolutely locked into the number six position for New Zealand. He might not be, but he should be, because he's absolutely done nothing wrong. And he is now the incumbent, and you've got to get past him to get into the team. So, yeah, he's had a great series.
Well, and I think what on that, I think absolutely, if he's not at number seven or six or wherever they want to put him in Blundell, you know, if he's not in the lineup, you know, whether Henry Nicholls survives after this, I think the question that, you know, people are going to hate me for saying this, but if they thought Henry Nicholls was the right player to play now, I don't think two tests in horrendous conditions has changed your mind, in particular if you're a selector. That's, again, not the decision I would make. I would put Phillips up to five or four, or probably five, put Mitchell at four, go with Blundell, go with Ravindra at seven, or whatever order you wanted to put, you know, that combination of four, five, six, seven, I would make that decision. But, you know, if we look at back to the New Zealand home summer last year, we had Michael Bracewell batting at seven. He's still injured. I think Glenn Phillips completely fills that role now and deserves to be in that spot. And I think what he did so well in this test, which we haven't... I mean, we talked about... Binksy, maybe I'll let you expand in a second about the options that he took. But I thought that what he did really is that he had a plan. And I know we talked a little bit last week about a lot of those batters that just didn't seem to have a plan against the spin, because... Yeah, when you're playing on difficult conditions and in different situations, you've got to kind of limit your game maybe into doing, you know, you can't play all the shots that you might have played on a flat wicket and at the Basin or in Perth or wherever you guys were talking about before. And I think the thing that stood out to me about Phillips is the way he used the crease. You know, it's not something I necessarily notice. You know, I'm not, you know, a big... I don't necessarily notice everything about batters, but he was able... He talked actually after the game about how he used the crease, or about how he decided, I'm not going to get hit on the pads. He said, you know, I'm going to use my bat. And it looked a bit unconventional at times. Sometimes his pads were out of the way and the ball's spinning and he's, you know, having to jam down on the ball when it didn't bounce. But the way he was able to play it really late, I think actually helped. And in those conditions, you might think actually going back is terrible, but he went, look, this, my hands are so quick, I can get down and kind of react to the ball. I'm going to get back. But yeah, Binksy, I mean, do you want to talk about the attack side of things? Because you said that was a big part of it for you.
Yeah, look, there's a lot to unpack there from both of your comments. I think come back to Raj, who's not on the pod. He always says things are never as good or as bad as they seem. And we're talking about a couple of knocks from a guy that's three tests into his career. Mm. We're talking about a situation where Michael Bracewell had a fantastic impact on all the formats he was playing for New Zealand. And I think if you go around the world in any other country, his injury, he'd come back into the side because he was the man in possession when he was injured. And I think then the other factor that sort of goes through my mind is we're often picking very, very different teams when we play away in subcontinent conditions. We'll come on and talk about England's squad to India in a minute, which will bear no resemblance to what they pick at home. And I'd hazard that your side won't have very much resemblance to what you've
picked. Not the bowling attack, certainly not the attack.
What you've picked away. So I think there's a lot of different permutations there. I'm worried for Ajaz and kind of where this leaves him when you've got Bracewell, Santner, Phillips and Rachin, who can all offer something with the ball from a spin perspective. And if you can get two or three of those guys into the side, it probably gives you enough of a spinning option that you don't need him. But from Phillips's performance in this test match, I thought what he did really, really well, aside from, you know, using the bat, which I think is an old fashioned way of playing spin. You know, you look at some of those, you know, guys, even in the relatively modern era, someone like Brian Lara didn't often, you know, get hit on the pad. He was like, I want to hit the ball. I want to play outside in front of my pad, which wasn't what you're taught in the textbook. It was to get your bat alongside your pad. But if you look at good players of spin, Kevin Peterson's another one that springs to mind that, you know, would have played in that kind of fashion. They're trying to access the ball. But what he did really, really well, I think, is he waited until the guys got too full to him. And then he trusted his ability from a range hitting, you know, a one day perspective to go, I'm going to hit this for six. It can't deviate as much as if it's a little bit shorter because it's right under my eyes and I'm going to back myself to get the required elevation to hit the ball out of the stand when I can. And when I then play and miss at one that does something absolutely ridiculous, then I'm just going to go, that doesn't matter. That ball has now passed. It hasn't got me out. And I'm gonna wait for that delivery that I'm able to put away. So,
and I think he's one of the best in the team at doing that. At least on externally, you can see him when one flies past his shoulder, and he's kind of like, whoa. And he like commentates it while he's there. He's fantastic while he's in that mood, you know, fantastic to watch and from an entertainment point of view.
And I think Santner also played his part clearly in that partnership as well. You know, 35 is worth, you know, 75 on that wicket. Yeah. So, you know, he batted, you know, really, really well throughout the course of, the course of that test match. Can we talk about the pitch?
Sure.
And the way I want to frame this, and I've kind of given you a little bit of a heads up. I remember having a very similar conversation when I think England got ambushed on a couple of Bunsen burners. I use the word ambush. That's not factual. It's opinion based. But, you know, I remember Raj again sort of saying, well, hold on a sec. Nah, you can't whinge about those pitches. So my question really is, you know, how is this massively different to a three-day test match at the Basin or at Perth or at Headingley or at the Wanderers where it seems around all over the shop and, you know, Norkia and Rabada or Anderson and Broad or Stark and Cummins and Hazelwood nick everyone off and the game's over in three days. How is that any worse than one that rags all over the place for 3 days?
Well, I'll answer because you're looking at me. One first point is I don't think we see those pitches very often anymore. You know, I think there was an article and I think Stuff put it out here in New Zealand around worst pitches ever because I think that comments come from Tim Southee. Basically, he came out after the test match and called it the worst pitch he's ever played on. And I think, you know, Stuff ranked the top five worst pitches that New Zealand have had. And some of them were New Zealand pitches, New Zealand conditions where we've, you know, if you want to use the ambush word, ambushed India before in the past. And I can think of a couple of occasions where, you know, India's been rolled for 100, you know, 100, not much more than that here in New Zealand. But they were like 20 years ago now. And I just don't think we see them. And look, that's not to say that those aren't different. Like, yes, but I think the big thing that stood out to me about this particular wicket is what Southee talked about, and it was just the fact that there was just no contest between bat and ball. And actually, when spinners got it right, it was actually just impossible to bat. It wasn't even like if you bat well, you can survive, or if you have some sort of game plan. And look, you know, what we've just said about Phillips kind of counters that a little bit, but I actually don't think Bangladesh bowled particularly well. And look, Phillips was dropped on naught. There were plenty of balls that went past the bat. It just became down to luck. Like, basically, if Bangladesh bowled the ball in the right area and the ball and the pitch did its thing, you actually couldn't play. And I think that's the part of it that I didn't enjoy. You know, worst pitch ever, I don't know, but I think that just the fact that there's nothing, like it was a genuine lottery, and you just don't see that very, very often.
Bordy?
As far as outcomes are concerned, a three-day test match where there's an uneven contest between bat and ball is not a good outcome for cricket or for its fans, no matter where it's played or no matter whether it's seaming or spinning. I think the issue that
I just say, it wasn't even a three-day test, to be fair. There was a day of rain in between. It was barely, you know, it was barely two and a bit days of cricket. So, yeah, you know, 3 days would have been nice.
And I agree. And the challenge that I have with this particular wicket is that there's not just seam, but there's excessive spin and uneven bounce. And the combination of those two things, you're trying to combat two dimensions of movement. And sometimes it's okay to combat a seaming ball if you're able to, you know, get down the wicket or, you know, play inside the ball or whatever. Where it gets really, really difficult if it is doing things in, you know, horizontal and vertical dimensions. I just want to read the quote, though, that the thing that got me is the quote from the Bangladesh captain after the test. And I want to read this verbatim because I think it's important. And there may be language barriers here that make this sound worse than it is. But this is the quote from the Bangladesh captain after the game. "When we play tests, we are not here to improve." I agree, completely agree. "This is not a place for practice. We are trying to win the test," Shanto said. So absolutely...
No problems there.
Absolutely 100%. He's absolutely right. This is from Crick Info that I'm reading for this. "It's important that we prepare to win the test," completely agree, "but we should definitely take this type of advantage. We can prepare in first-class cricket by trying out good wickets. We should prepare wickets like these and wickets like away conditions in NCL, i.e. the National Cricket League, or BCL, the Bangladesh Cricket League." This is the issue that I have with this wicket, is there is no pretense that this was a good cricket wicket, right? Mohammad Hafeez, the Pakistan cricket manager, has come out this week in the warm-up game between Australia and Pakistan and said that he was very disappointed with the wicket conditions that Australia had prepared for that test match. And many might agree with him. The corollary is that the ground was underwater a week in advance of the test match. So there's only so much you can do to prepare a wicket in those kinds of conditions. Mm. It seems to me that there was no effort, maybe the wrong word, there's no desire to produce a good cricket wicket in this circumstance. The desire is to produce a cricket wicket that maximises one team's chance of winning, and it's backfired in this case. And I don't think that is a good advertisement for test cricket, for neutral fans, or for the game in general, regardless of whether or not it resulted in Bangladesh winning or losing the test match, and they've lost it in this particular instance, thanks to an excellent effort from Glenn Phillips and maybe some subpar bowling from their spin department.
Yeah, look, it's a really interesting one, because I think when you're parochial about it, and you know, I have been in the past when, you know, I we referred to those two tests in India that England played. We played on a flat deck and won the test match, and then literally got, you know, spun to death. But then I kind of then think back and think about, you know, other sports, and you think about football, where, you know, you would literally mow the grass differently on your home pitch, so that, you know, the ball would stay in the corners if you wanted to play a long ball game and just boot the ball over the top. Or if you had two great wingers, you'd extend the pitch and make it wider. Or, you know, if you didn't and your central midfield players were really good, you'd go to the minimum width of football pitch. So I guess for me, there isn't a rule about this, that, you know, that there is a home conditions component to test cricket. So you know, we use cricket balls all around the world that are different as well. It's one of those things. I'm asking the question as to whether it should be something that you have to be able to counter. It isn't the responsibility of the home side to produce the best cricket wicket. It's to produce the best cricket wicket to suit their team.
But fans will vote with their feet then, right? Like, and cricket fans should vote with their feet by choosing not to watch games where it doesn't produce an even contest between bat and ball. I mean, test cricket is struggling enough as it is in the face of the rising popularity of T20, that a game like this does nothing for the betterment of test cricket for the average casual fan. Right now, you can argue that, you know, Australia producing a wicket that seams where we roll Pakistan or whatever, as has happened in the past, or England producing a green seamer for a visiting subcontinent team, is exactly the same thing. But the reality is that there is a more even contest between bat and ball in a lot of those test matches than there were in this particular instance. I'm not saying that subcontinent teams shouldn't produce spinning pitches. They absolutely can, and I would love to bowl on them. And there is some terrific cricket played on low, slow turning wickets. But when it goes too far, as it has done in this circumstance, it is not a great advertisement for the betterment of test cricket. And we're going to lose fans as a result, and we're already doing so.
Well, and I mean, to pick up on that, if you look back to the first test, you know, I'm a big advocate of the home conditions, and, you know, I think in that debate I probably was on the side of, you know, yes, India should use that advantage. You know, I think it's great that you go around the world and you play in different conditions, and you've got to counter the conditions that are there, and you've got to come up with new ways to be an excellent batter, and you know, that's how we judge the greats, that they can play in all of those different conditions, and they have home and away. You know, think about our Hall of Fame. The home and away records is something we looked at for pretty much all the batters that we talked about. But look back at that first test. I think we got a great test match because of the conditions. They were really tough to score at, but 300 was a good score, and it was you know, if you bowled really, really well, which is what Tigel did in that first test, he was able to get a lot of success. New Zealand spinners weren't able to bowl with the consistency that he was. So there, the Bangladesh batters were able to counter that and score in lots of different areas. You look back at this test and it just was like, it wasn't like, okay, it's favouring Bangladesh because they have better spinners. It was just, it's favouring anyone who bowls on that spot, and nobody can combat some of the balls that were being bowled. And that's the point that Bawley made. It's the point that Tim Southee's been making.
Yeah.
It turned from this is a challenge to this is luck now.
I think the quality of the wicket can sometimes be summed up by the fact that, you know, Michael Clarke gets 6 for 9 or Joe Root gets a 5 for, like,
I know.
I'm all for a part-timer getting a big bag, but you know what I mean, right? It's when those guys are able to dominate the opposition, it's not brilliant, even if it's great for that particular player.
Yeah. Look, I don't think we're going to come to consensus on this, because I think from my perspective, the only reason I turned on and watched the last 90 minutes is because I saw the Slack blowing up and saying this is ridiculous. I was like, I'm going to tune in and watch the horror show. So I think in terms of your, you know, eyeballs on the game, I tuned in specifically to watch something that was ludicrous. and I think that sometimes that is the beauty of seeing different pitches. This one maybe went too far, and I think certainly that balance between bat and ball wasn't there. But you know, I don't think we always see that balance between bat and ball. And sometimes we talked about one dayers. We talked about the fact we don't always want to see the homogenised flat wicket where it's 330 plays 330. We occasionally want to see one where, you know, it seems around a little bit and all of a sudden you've got someone, you know, 20 for 4 in the power play, and it's a bit more of an interesting game to watch. But yeah, we probably won't come to consensus. What do we want to talk about in terms of, I want to ask a question, like, and look, this is an obvious one. One each and we've not got a deciding test match, two test match series. This has got to be again another blot in the copybook of the scheduling. But what, you know, what now for New Zealand? Where does this rank in terms of test match victories away from home for you, do you think?
Well, look, I did see a bit of, even, you know, in our friend group, a bit of chat going around about, you know, this is one of the New Zealand's best away wins ever. And look, I'm not a historian of the game. I'm terrible at remembering results and all that kind of stuff. But I do think that, you know, Raj and I talked last week about how our expectations for this tour especially were that New Zealand would go over there and win.
Yep.
And I think in hindsight, maybe that was being a bit too aggressive. New Zealand, you know, have had struggles in the past going over to Bangladesh. We haven't had it easy over there. But I think, you know, the reason I did that is because I looked on paper and went, look, they're missing Shakib, they're missing Tuscan, they're missing players. Tummy McBold's situation, they'd been terrible at the World Cup. New Zealand is a better side than them, I think, and that they, you know, they should have done better.
Is this a triumph over the conditions as much as a triumph over the opposition? It doesn't feel like this is New Zealand's greatest win against a high quality opposition in a very tough game. I think this is New Zealand have conquered both the opposition and the wicket to a certain extent and pulled a victory that looked unlikely from a conditions point of view. So I don't think it's necessarily... It's a great win for New Zealand, don't get me wrong. It's a great win for Phillips and Santner to chase down some very, very difficult conditions, chase down those runs. But I don't think this is New Zealand's greatest performance in terms of the quality of opposition that they're playing, with no disrespect to the Bangladesh team, who are, as you say, missing a lot of superstars and a lot of very high quality players.
Yeah, and look, I think that probably sums it up better than I can, because I think also the fact that they'd lost that first test made this test feel even more
significant
yeah. because of the way that they bounced back and they had to, you know, look, Southee lost both those tosses. They had to bat second and last on in both those games. That proved very, very difficult in that first test, and it looked like it was going to be again. You know, Glenn Phillips came in at 50 for 5 in both innings. Mm. You know, it looked like, you mentioned the contribution that Santner made. When those two were at the crease, it looked like New Zealand could be all out 60, 70, 80. Yeah. Like, it was very, you know, it was dire straits for New Zealand there. We were looking, you know, Blundell, Conway, all these players that we've come to rely on, they looked completely at sea, and it looked like they were going to crumble again. So look, it's an important win for New Zealand, because look, we go back to home summer now. And, you know, if it was whatever it is, you know, we go home and we have no points on the board from this World Test Championship. We mentioned it last week. We've got South Africa at home now, a couple of tests. They, it looks like, are going to bring their second side. Then we have Australia. You know, then we have a lot of tough encounters after that. We're away in India at one point. We're away in Sri Lanka.
Yeah.
You know, we play England at home next summer. So there's a lot of tough challenges coming up. And, you know, we sort of hyperbolically kind of said, is it the World Test Championship over for New Zealand after that first loss? But I think two losses in the bounce, and it might have felt that way. So yeah, look, I think it's credit to those guys coming back. And even, you know, the likes of Ajaz and Santner, and, you know, there was a huge amount of criticism on Ajaz after that first test performance. And, you know, for him to bounce back and get 9 wickets in the match, and particularly 6 for in that second innings, again, look, it's friendly conditions, but
you've got to put the ball in the right areas, as Bangladesh showed. You have to put the ball in the right areas as a spinner if you're going to take wickets in the subcontinent. And if you don't, you're going to get pummeled.
Exactly. And actually, you know, like we talked about a bit last week, but he's got the best average of any spinner that's taken 50 test wickets for New Zealand. Like, yes, you got to put the conditions on that he only really plays in spin-friendly conditions. And someone like Daniel Vettori, who, you know, I think AJ's average is 29 now, Daniel Vettori averages about 34. He had to do countless overs and, you know, bowling on flat wickets in Australia, on flat wickets, you know, on glued pitches in New Zealand, and all of these tough, you know, these tough stints and many, many overs kind of carrying our attack. But Ajaz has given a pretty good account of himself when he's been given the opportunities. And yes, you know, it's a tough gig being a spinner in New Zealand, and the way that the spinners are being used in terms of, you know, you only play these away games, you play 2 or 3, 4 tests a year,
max.
and you're supposed to come in those games and win us the game. And look, he put his best foot forward in this game, so I'm just really happy for him.
Agreed.
Look, let's move away from New Zealand, Bangladesh. We'll probably continue with the pitches theme, though. We're going to lead into the Australia-Pakistan test series.
Sounds good to me.
Mohammad Hafeez, I think we've already mentioned, team directors criticised the pitch and the conditions for Pakistan's warm-up game. Mm-hmm. Normally, it's a one-day game, isn't it, that President's game? But they've been playing it as a...
Yeah, it's been a four-day game the last 2 years, but up until then, it's been a limited overs fixture, yeah.
Yeah, so playing in Canberra, I think you mentioned, Bordy, it had been pretty wet, so there's probably not too much to say about this, but then it's going to be over to the Wacker. And again, I've got no problem with this. It's, you know, you play in Canberra or Cairns or Brisbane, and then the first test somewhere completely alien. That's part of playing overseas, isn't it?
I think so, yeah. I think as much as we want an even contest between bat and ball, but I am a big advocate for all nations having some level of natural home conditions playing a part, whether it's spin in the subcontinent or pace and bounce in Australia and South Africa, seam and swing in England, and to a lesser extent here in New Zealand. Absolutely. In defence of the Manuka Oval situation, yeah, the ground was literally underwater not that long ago, like completely underwater. So preparing a good cricket wicket can be challenging in those circumstances when you have to float the roller out to the middle in order to get on the deck. It is a low surface in Canberra. Normally, it is not a pacey, bouncy wicket at Manuka Oval.
Was the issue that it was just too flat? Because didn't Shan Mahood
too slow?
Because Shan Mahood scored a double 100, didn't he?
Yeah, and all the Australian batters in the bat off that we will get to all scored 49 or more.
Yeah.
In that audition to replace David Warner at some point in the future. But yeah, there wasn't a lot for the bowlers to take from that series, which is, I think, a bit of a disappointment for Pakistan, because they're looking for guys to step up going into this test series. They've got an attack that's missing some key elements to it. And I think they were hoping that their guys would get a little bit more confidence, a little bit more pep in their step going into Perth, knowing what they can expect from that pace attack, because they're looking for someone to stand up to support our favourite player in the Pakistan team, Shaheen Shah Afridi. Who's a bit of a lone gun.
Yeah, who didn't play this warm-up game, and neither did Hassan Ali, I don't think, did he?
No, and I think those guys are locked in for that Pakistan team in the first test, so they will be managing their workloads and all that kind of sports psychology talk.
So you mentioned that bat-off, so Marcus Harris, Matt Renshaw, Cameron Green, and Cameron Bancroft. yeah, what did we take anything out of that warm-up game?
It's hard to, because they all got starts, and Renshaw happened to go on and get 130 batting at three. And I think he was not out, was he, at the end of the the end of the innings? Cameron Green got some runs, etc. So I don't think we've really learned anything, and unfortunately the selectors probably haven't learned anything either. The challenge with those guys is Bancroft's got like 600s in 18 months, so he's been scoring a lot of runs. Prior to this season, Harris had been scoring a lot of runs in Shield cricket as well, and Renshaw's always been there or thereabouts in the minds of the selectors. So I don't think this has really told us anything, other than they're all pretty similar kind of, you know, players at the moment. They all average somewhere in the order of 38 to 40 at first class level. None of them have really made their mark at test level, so there's no real standout character here, which is why there's a lot of talk in the press about should Marnus open, should Travis Head go up to open the batting,
and he said he's not going to do that.
He doesn't want to do it. He's happy to bat at five, which is probably fair enough, because for two reasons: one, he's a great counter-attacking number five, he's one of the best we've had in a little while, and two, he's probably not going to get the same treatment from the short ball at number five than he is at number one. You know, you'd often face quite juicy conditions first morning of the test match. So if he has a weakness against short pitch bowling, much more likely, in my view, to be exploited by a hard new ball in juicy conditions than maybe 2 or 3 hours into the test where it's kind of settled down a bit in terms of the wicket. So, should Mitchell Marsh open the batting? Should Cam Green go up to four? Look, there are so many possible permutations for Australia at the moment, and unfortunately, none of those guys have really, in this fixture, differentiated themselves from the opposition, except for maybe Renshaw. But in my view, he's probably, I think, in the minds of the selectors, the third guy in the pecking order anyway. So what do we tell from this series? I don't really know.
What do you want to see happen once Warner goes? Because, I mean, look, it's... Yeah, a lot of their attention has been on him the last couple of weeks because of Mitchell Johnson's comments and all of that kind of stuff. But it actually isn't that far away now, right? So he's got this series and then we're done for Warner.
Yeah, series.
Three test series against Pakistan.
Yep. And I think that finishes in Sydney, if I remember rightly, which is the one that David Warner wants to go out on. And then we'll find out in the West Indies series who's going to open with Usman Khawaja long term. What would I like to see happen? I'm actually not really that sure, because for me, none of those guys have really differentiated themselves at test level or first class level. They've all had some reasonably good first class careers. Cameron Bancroft scored a lot of runs. I think in the mind of a lot of Australian fans, Cameron Bancroft is still suffering from the aftermath of the South Africa incident, and probably carries a black mark in the minds of a lot of Australian cricket fans. We've tried Marcus Harris at test level a number of times. He hasn't really come off. I don't know that trying Marcus Harris again is the way forward for Australia. We've tried Matt Renshaw a couple of times, and he had a really good build-up to the last time he played test cricket, and then away and had two tests, didn't make any runs, and has now fallen back the pecking order. So, look, I don't really know.
Someone has a good big bash. Could they put themselves in the window?
Absolutely, and that's what the selectors have actually said. They've actually said that white ball runs maybe has some currency. So we might see something completely different. Look, I would like to see, all other things being equal, a healthy Will Pukowski open the batting for Australia, because I think he's the long-term answer until one of these guys like Teague Wiley or Chandrasinghe or Henry Hunt or there's a new guy from Australia, from New South Wales, no surprise that there's reps on that kid because he wears a blue cap. Bantnos, I think, is his name. He's an 18-year-old who's batted at three, made his Shield debut yesterday, so he's already being anointed as a future opener for Australia after one game in the New South Wales cap, which should be no surprise to any fans of New South Wales cricket. And I wear my Queensland badge very proudly, obviously, having said that. But look, I think it's going to be a stopgap measure for a couple of years, but we really need to find two openers, really.
Yeah, because Khawaja.
Because Khawaja has got 2-3 years, maybe more.
He's a little bit mercurial, isn't he? He could decide at the end of this series that he's done.
Absolutely. He could. And he walks to the beat of his own drummer. Yeah. He's been dropped by Australian cricket so many times that I don't think he's got any swan song in his mind. He's probably still thinking, I could be dropped after any particular test match. So I don't know which way they'll go, but I would like to see Pukowski be the guy long-term for Australia, because he's the only guy who averages 40 plus in Shield cricket. And to me, that should be the benchmark. Absolute minimum.
But I mean, Binksy, you can answer this if you want. I mean, we're going to see 3-0 Australia, though, aren't we? Like, is there any scenario where Pakistan can put up a big fight here? I mean, their record in Australia has not been good. It, you know, if you look at... any side that comes to Australia, touring side, they seem to just get demolished. That's sort of part of part of the summer, I guess. The fixtures, we just know that that's going to happen. Is there any way that they can turn this around?
Yeah, I think historically you're probably dead right. You wouldn't the bookmakers given much of a chance. I think the thing is that you've got to be able to do in Australia is you've got to be able to put 350, 400 on the board. Mm. And I do think that these guys have got the capability to do that. So from a batting lineup perspective, they've got a couple of guys, more than a couple of guys, in fact. I think if I look at Imam, if I look at Shan Masood, if I look at Babar Azam, I look at Saeed Shakil's come onto the scene.
Yeah, I like their top five.
Look really good. Sarfraz, in the second or maybe even third phase of his international career. So they've got, I think, the ability to put 350, 400 on the board. I think where they're going to struggle a little bit is, we alluded to it, who's going to really back up Shin Shah Afridi and potentially Harris Rife from a bowling perspective. And I just think
it looks like Abrar maybe is injured as well, actually.
Yeah, he's injured. A couple of injuries to their bowling attack.
Yeah.
So I just think you look at then the quality that's on offer from Australia's bowling attack, that they're going to have, we don't even need to name them. And Nathan Lyon in the hunt for his 500th test wicket. Yeah. I don't give him much chance. Border, you'll probably go the other way.
No, I think Australia should win and should win comfortably, but we just don't know what Pakistan team we're going to get, right? Are we going to get the one where Shan Masood stands up and gets a double hundred as he did in Canberra, or are we going to get the one that we got in the World Cup where they were great for three or four games and then, I don't know. It's so hard to prepare against Pakistan because you just don't know what you're going to get, right? And I think it's worth remembering, the last time I think they played in Australia, they got within 30 or 40 of chasing down that 400 score at the Gabba on the last day of the test. So they have the ability to score runs in Australia. I'm just not sure that failing, that other than Australia's batters having a below par series, like a Smith getting out in weird ways three or four times or Marnus having a lean trot, I don't see how they're going to bowl Australia out often enough to get a test victory. But stranger things have happened.
Binksy, you wanted to talk a little bit about England. We mentioned the ODI series last week that they had against West Indies. A couple more games happen in that, but you predicted that England would bounce back, but not quite to win the series. That didn't quite pan out that way. But I think you wanted to talk more about what their test side that's been named for India.
Yeah, so I think probably just to touch on the ODIs, I still find it really, really bizarre that we're playing an ODI series and then we don't play again any ODI cricket until September.
Next year?
We can't be this year, can we? Unless you've got a flux capacitor handy, Baldy.
Not handy.
So I think we don't play, until September next year. ODIs, you're making me date myself now, but I'm pretty sure that's the case. Didn't quite bounce back, but that final game was a little bit of a stop-start affair under the Duckworth Lewis. Mm. England blown away in the power play by debutant Matthew Ford, looked really impressive, 3 for 20 odd. And then it took a bit of a bright spot from Ben Duckett to get us out of the poo. And I think that's really the story of that series for England, that they only really had one batter stand up in each game, really. Yeah. Harry Brook had a decent knock, Josh Butler had a decent knock, and Harry Brook had a decent knock, but we couldn't string together partnerships. And then West Indies, to be fair, I wouldn't say got over the line convincingly. I think England actually fought back pretty well with the ball. Bizarrely, Will Jacks, who couldn't get a bowl early in the series, was the guy that sort of opened the door for an unlikely victory. But they couldn't get over the line. But what's really caught my eye is Jofra Archer's been out there. So our central contracts are loose as. Rob Key being interviewed by George De Bell, and George De Bell breaks the news to him that Jofra Archer's just played a club game, a three-day club cricket.
That's pretty awesome, isn't it?
Yeah, so I think over a number of Saturdays. So I think he'd played in the first game. Let's take this with a pinch of salt. He got 4 for and 11 runs. one of his wickets was taken bowling left arm spin, so it can't have been too taxing a standard. One would suggest, unless of course it was an absolute Bunsen, and you know that was the, you know that was the best option. But then the thing that's really caught my eye, and really interested to get your views on this, we've talked about spin a hell of a lot, is England have announced their test squad to go to India. So I think probably just from a recap perspective, we obviously went to Pakistan last year, the emergence of Will Jacks on that tour. So he was picked as almost a frontline spinner. He doesn't even make the squad. England have gone in with Jack Leach, not surprisingly.
Yep.
But then no room for Liam Dawson, who had a stellar year in county cricket and, you know, literally has got every single branded England 12th man bib from the last 5 years or so in his kit bag. So, you know, he's not going. I think has got some franchise gigs. So maybe he just said, do you know what? I don't want to go mix the Gatorade. I'll stick with my franchise commitments. But we've picked Shoaib Bashir, 10 first class wickets at the average of about 60, I believe, with a best of 3 for 67.
Young though, isn't he? Young.
He is young, yeah. He's 20 years old. And then Tom Hartley, left arm spin. So both what both of these guys have got in common, apparently Shoaib Bashir has got one of the highest release points of any spinner, apparently. That, so if that's in the press release, I think you're struggling a little bit in terms of, you know, all right, we can't really talk up his 10 first last week, it's too much, but he's got a high release point.
Hey, look, high release point was very, very important next year on those Bangladesh wickets. Mitchell Sent, the way he was able to exploit
Akshar as well. So I wonder whether that, you know, there is a little bit of an analytics going in there. But Tom Hartley, the other guy, left arm spinner, and Ben Folkes back in the squad as well. Apparently Johnny Bairstow's got a little bit of a nudge about his fitness. You know, told to kind of get himself in peak condition. But yeah, I just really want to see Folkes keeping wicket in that side. But with Stokes not able to bowl again, I just wonder how they're going to be able to facilitate that. So it might be another series of disappointment for me. But yeah, keen to get your view on the spinners. Can two guys who have played, you know, with all due respect, 50 first class wickets between them, really go out and actually make an impact in India in a what will probably be at least a two man spin attack, if not all three of them playing. Well, Rayan Ahmed's there as well.
I mean, what I think was weird about that selection. Look, I don't really have an issue with taking. I mean, essentially, Key said that he's there to those guys are there for experience in a way, and Hartley is there to be a Jack Leach replacement if Leach is unavailable. So I don't especially have a huge amount of problems with that. But the Dawson one was weird. I mean, now that you say that there's some franchise stuff, you know, maybe he has had a word there. But Key's quote, I feel like Key said something like he doesn't want to come and be the 12th man. It's almost like in club cricket where, you know, sometimes you struggle to pick a guy from your third grade side up to your second grade side because they go, oh, look, I'd rather bat six and, you know, bowl a few overs in third grade than come up to reserve grade and, you know, bat eight and not bowl. So it's sort of like, I don't know, when you're playing for your country, you feel like actually being there would be quite important, and going on a tour and getting your foot in the door, and you never know, you know, Jack Leach has gone over there and been sick in the past, and
yeah,
you know, there's opportunities come up. So I'm surprised in that sense that that's sort of the rationale. But, you know, I think really they're looking at that series and going, okay, well, we've got Leach, we've got Rayan Ahmed, and we've got Joe Root, who will probably play a significant part in their bowling. So you don't need any more than the three spinners that they'll have on the park. It's just
to Raj's theory, they can only bowl two.
Well,
one from each end. Yeah.
Yeah. So look, I think as long as everyone stays fit, I don't think that's an issue. And I guess, you know, things change so quickly these days. If one of those guys was injured for a significant amount of time, I'm sure they'd be able to fly someone else over there as a substitute. But I guess it doesn't kind of send the right message potentially. But, you know, look, I kind of don't doubt much that's happening with that English test side, at least, because
and that's the thing, you cannot really argue with their selections until they've had the opportunity, because everything that McCollum's really touched has turned to gold so
far. And he picked, you know, he I mean, look, it seemed like Rehan Ahmed was someone that, that had been earmarked for the England side for a long time, but it seemed like as well from the outside, having, you know, knowing nothing about his early stages of his career and county cricket really, that McCullum was like, this guy's got some talent, I'm getting him in around the squad. And since then he's been playing, you know, lots of different formats for England. So, you know, he's someone that they obviously see a big, big future in. And look, if he's probably now going to get his opportunity properly over in India, if it's the conditions that we think it is, and that they will be playing two spinners. And like you said, with no Will Jacks, Rehan Ahmed's probably going to have to bat eight maybe and contribute with the bat maybe as well. And that seems to be something that potentially is there for him in the future. So, yeah, he's someone that, you know, in terms of his development and long-term outlook for England, this series potentially could be quite interesting in terms of what happens for him.
And Baldy, have you seen a little bit of Rehan Ahmed?
I've seen little bits. I mean, there's obviously something about him, and I'm hoping that England are taking these two young guys, Hartley and Bashir, because they see something in them and they want to invest in their future and they want to invest in Rehan Ahmed's future. I think the thing that England and to a certain extent Australia have done for a little bit of time is pick a spinner to go on a tour and then maybe discard them and they never sort of see the light of day again. So I'm hoping that England continue to invest in these young kids, and if they are showing promise, even though their first class record now doesn't back it up, that they keep having them involved in those squads. I'm hoping that they get to play a lot of A cricket going forward and get that exposure against quality opposition, because it would be the worst thing for their careers for them to go on one tour, get a little bit of exposure and maybe they play our game and get pumped or whatever, and then get discarded for the next shiny bright spinner that comes along. So I'm hopeful that they'll continue to invest in these kids, because if we're right and McCullum does see something in them, then there's obviously going to be opportunities in that white ball squad going forward, because Adil Rashid and Mo Ali aren't going to be around forever. So there will be opportunities going forward.
Although they've just got off the plane and they're in the Caribbean for this T20
but
series.
Not forever.
Yes, but not forever. For the next World Cup,
it's quite early to be naming this squad, isn't it? Because India, you know, India's got a three-test or two-test series against South Africa that they're playing. Well, I mean, they're obviously playing the white ball stuff now, but then they're playing a test series against South Africa before they play this England series. So there's a lot of water to go under the bridge. Because, I mean, you know, when I was thinking about, you know, test cricket coming up, that South Africa-India series is one that I'm actually quite looking forward to. You know, I haven't looked at the TV schedules here in New Zealand, but I'm really hoping Sky has that series, because, yeah, the prospect of, I mean, we've talked about Jaiswal a lot. It looks like he might, you know, hopefully we'll get another opportunity in test cricket for India. Obviously did really well in West Indies at his debut. And, you know, that South African attack, particularly after this World Cup, with, you know, still missing Norkia, but, you know, Jansen and Rabada and Kutsia against some of those Indian batters, it's a pretty enticing prospect for me as a neutral.
Yeah, look, it's going to be a cracking New Zealand summer, and obviously some tours that we're going to be able to tune into. I don't know why England have named that squad so early. I guess by the time the guys get back from the Caribbean from this T20 series now, it'll be what, nearly Christmas, I would gather. I think the last game's around the 20th or something like that.
Yep.
And then this squad flies out for some prep in the UAE, I think mid-January or something like that. So that I don't know whether it's just to give that early warning or whether or not there might be some impending auctions or decisions that need to be made around franchise deals potentially. And you know, for the likes of your James Andersons, your Johnny Bairstows, you know your Brooks, your Crawleys, your Ducketts, the guys that are, you know, definitely going to be there, they would know what's going on. But it might have been for some of those other guys that, you know, they might be getting, you know, Rehan Ahmed, for example, you know, might have been getting a gig in one of those, you know, one of those tournaments otherwise. So I don't know the rationale behind it. Should we finish on a light note, or have you got something else you want to cover first?
Can I give some praise to Shai Hope in the West Indies?
Yeah, absolutely.
After that series, yeah. Another 100 for Shai Hope, another 50 for Shai Hope. Continues to average 51 in ODI cricket. There's a number that sort of jumps off the page at you straight away. He is starting to rebuild West Indies cricket a little bit again, and I'm really excited by it. It's teasing us again.
It is. I just, I wasn't, yeah, yeah, no pun intended, but I hope it doesn't, yeah, come to nothing. Andre Russell back in the squad for the T20s as well. So he's obviously wants another crack at the big dance.
But a bunch of them turning down contracts again. I mean, you know, that's pretty standard now. Yeah. You know, a little bit was made of it, but yeah, it's pretty standard now. And you know, New Zealand, we obviously see Trent Bolton and a range of other players.
But it was great. I thought Alec Athanase was good throughout the course of the series. I thought Matthew Ford's debut was pretty decent. Moti looked good, left arm spinner as well. So I think some options there for West Indies. And look, it's a great place to go and tour, isn't it? So you want to be playing, you know, you want them to be playing longer series because they, you know, they deserve to be doing so. So that, you know, you get that, you know, particularly that fan experience. It's definitely on my bucket list at a Caribbean tour. But beer in the first session, rum in the final session.
Sounds pretty good to me.
There's the theory. We'll do that at the Basin Reserve this year instead.
Before you do go to the lighter note, can I just say back to Bangladesh, New Zealand, and all the scheduling stuff. Absolutely mad that now they're going to be playing one dayers in a week's time here in, you know, all of them jump on a plane, go to a different country. They're about to play one dayers. New Zealand has picked resting a lot of guys in their squad, which means we get to see a few fresh faces. And Will O'Rourke is one that in particular I'm very much looking forward to.
Well, and Andy Ashok as well, who we talked about the other week, didn't we? Not quite ready for international cricket, but he's got his gig.
Well, no, look, yeah. I mean, he's obviously played a T20 for New Zealand. He's certainly someone in the mix. And I think that's what we see now, isn't it? That people get introduced through this white ball. I think he'll probably get I think if New Zealand does this well, he'll probably get the Rehan Ahmed treatment. He'll start to be introduced into these white ball series where there's opportunities, and hopefully his cricket will develop. But yeah, look, you know, on Eddie, I just think a couple of years, you know, learning his craft. It's spin bowling, tough gig, especially leg spin bowling. So, you know, he's a young player. If he can learn his craft and improve his cricket, he has real potential to be a big player for New Zealand. But yeah, back on O'Rourke. O'Rourke is the one that I'm really, really, really interested to see how he goes. He's, you know, went on this. New Zealand's been looking for the past 18 months, 12 months, possibly even longer, really, for, you know, some new seamers to step into this and younger seamers to step into the fold when inevitably, you know, we've seen Bolt, we've got Southee, we've got Wagner. When these guys kind of, even Matt Henry, you know, he's you know, over 30. So once these guys kind of do move on, who are the next crop coming up? And Will O'Rourke had a really nice season last year for Canterbury, played it, got his opportunity for New Zealand A, bowled really, really well on that New Zealand A tour to Australia. And now we're going to hopefully get to, I just want to see him get his opportunity and play because he's got a bit of gas. There is some talent out there in New Zealand first class cricket on these young seamers. And yeah, hopefully we're going to get to see that in this ODI series coming up.
Absolutely. Let's get to Geelong. So I know, Border, you're probably keen to actually get home, aren't you? Because we're into the Big Bash League and the Brisbane Heat, your home side, kick off in about 10 minutes time against the Sydney Thunder, who've just chosen to field. There's your live time check to know that this is not being generated in the AI world. This is real shit here on the Top Order podcast. But we've got a game called off, six and a bit overs in due to an unsafe pitch. Bordy, anything to say here, or is this just a frivolous way to end the podcast with a bit of beef?
Frivolous way to end the podcast. What happened in Geelong? Didn't the covers blow off or something ridiculous, and it got wet, or something like that, or the water got under the covers and unsafe?
The captain's report at the toss was it was drenched, apparently.
Yeah, Nick Madden's sense. Not great.
Yeah. And yeah, I don't know if you saw it, but
it was pretty bad.
And I guess actually just lucky, really, that someone didn't get grilled.
Yeah, well, I think that's why they called it off, right? Yeah. I think the umpires went, okay, we need to call this off before someone actually gets hurt in this game. Because there's one that went through kind of stump height, and then the one off the same length went through and, you know, went straight over Josh Inglis's head. So even Aaron Finch was kind of going, yeah, I think this is probably... it's probably time to sort of go to the sheds and play a game of cards, boys. But yeah, look, not a great look for Geelong cricket, but, you know, extenuating circumstances with, you know, it sounds like water getting in under the covers. There was a bit of talk about why there weren't more covers and why the whole ground wasn't covered in covers, and we knew it was going to rain, and why didn't we bring in more covers? I mean, there's only so much you can really do other than covering the entire ground, which happens in some places.
Again, I don't want to extend this for no reason, but there was an interesting point No, one that made me think, let's put it like that, Ashton Turner, who was the captain of the Scorchers, who probably were pretty keen to play given their recent Big Bash form, right? You know, they're going to win every tournament they play, so they're pretty confident. He said we need to look at some flexibility with the playing conditions. For example, can we play from one end?
I think when it gets to that point, though, that is when you're like, okay, like what are we doing here? Like, yeah. if it's to the point where, you know, we're having to manufacture the situation that much,
yeah,
there obviously is
an issue. You can't bowl a left arm because one side's wet. Yeah,
okay. I mean, that's what they do. I mean, that's why in test matches they have the light meter, right?
Yeah.
So that they can't go, okay, well, you can just bowl spin forever because it's getting dark and, you know, it's easy to see the spinners, so it's fine. Now they go, look, it's reached this point, we're off. Yeah. I mean, it's not great for the fans. I mean, I'm sure the fans would probably rather have sat there and watched play from one end than, yep, you know.
If this was 2003 and not 2023 and this was the infancy of T20 cricket, I would have absolutely agreed with you that you could play from one end because people weren't taking it all that seriously. Cricket didn't take itself that seriously. But now we do, and it's a $1 billion industry, and I think you probably are a bit dicey to play from one end.
And I guess partly maybe the reason this is coming up is, you know, Geelong's not going to see too many fixtures, no, are they? True. So if this was at the MCG, there probably wouldn't have been the same conversation. Mm-hmm. But then that leans into, if you are going to take the game on the road to some more regional centres, then they've got to have the facilities to make sure they can get the game on.
Yeah, and I think this was a bit of a one-off. Like, this is unfortunately a one-off.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. And certainly, thoughts with those in Australia that might be just about to go through some rough weather as well. So cyclone just about to hit, I believe, the eastern seaboard. So, yeah, fingers crossed. Not too much disruption, not only to cricket, but also to that eastern seaboard of Australia. But look, that's probably a good place to end the pod for this evening. We will be back next week. Lots and lots more cricket, as we say, every single week.
Maybe a bit of an auction next week to talk about.
Yeah, we've got an auction to talk about. We've got some previews that will be, you know, massively wrong and all that kind of jazz.
And it's the Christmas episode of the Top Order Podcast.
The Cricketmas episode.
Exactly.
Yeah, absolutely. So, driving home for Christmas. There,
exactly. What are we grateful for? All that kind of stuff. What costumes did we wear? What candy did we get? All those things.
Right, you're in charge of that for next week. Yeah, but for us, that is absolutely the right place to end the podcast. From Auckland, it's good night and God bless. We'll see you next week. Good night.
Sports Social Podcast Network.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered ChumbaCasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+ terms and conditions apply. See website for details.